It's cognitive science plus computational neuroscience plus AI.
You know, let's say a big brawl breaks out. Who's going to win it, the computational neuroscientists or the cognitive scientists?
Oh, neither. They each of them has half the truth or a third of the truth, I'd say.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hello and welcome. This is Paul Middlebrooks. This episode of Brain Inspired is brought to you by me. My time, attention, tears, wallet, all that jazz. You'll notice perhaps I don't use advertisements on the show, nor do I plan to, unless it's for a good cause, like hot air balloons, perhaps, or ridding the world of domesticated cats. Other things that would make the world better. I do love doing the show, but it does take a lot of effort. You could most definitely help by telling a friend and or leaving a review on iTunes. Today, I talk with Niko Krigaskorta. Krigaskorta. Try one last time here. It's a little nuanced. Krigaskorta. Okay, sounded less angry that time. That's good. Niko's a professor at Columbia University, and for years has been at the forefront of this intersection of neuroscience and AI, so he's a poster child for this show, if you will. Instead of focusing on any of his research findings today, we talk really quite broadly about how deep neural networks can be harnessed to understand how our brains work. And Niko and his colleagues have coined the term cognitive computational neuroscience, and they run an annual conference by that name as well. And the goal is to join three fields into one. Namely, cognitive science provides a high-level, top-down approach exploring how information processing in our brains leads to our behaviors. Computational neuroscience, on the other hand, provides more of a bottom-up approach, explores more how that information process is carried out at the level of neurons and ensembles of neurons and circuits of neurons. And then finally, in the middle, you have artificial intelligence, which acts as a bridge between the two levels, exploring what algorithms might be carrying out these processes in the brain. Okay, so Niko describes all of this stuff much more in depth in the episode. This is fun. We also talk about things like how many realistic details we eventually need to include in models to satisfy our thirst for understanding brains, and of course, plenty more. Niko is on Twitter. He is at Krigaskorta Lab, and he suggests that you learn more about him and what he does by visiting the website for the Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference. So that will be linked in the show notes as well as all the other things we mentioned. So find those at braininspired.co/podcast/12. Thank you for listening, and please enjoy our conversation. Niko Krigaskorta. I know I'm butchering that, but welcome to the podcast and thanks for being here.
That's pretty good, actually, Paul.
Give us the real one.
Krigaskorta.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to work on it. So I will have introduced you and pronounced it perfectly in the introduction, but I'll say a bit here. So you're a professor of psychology and at Columbia University and director of the Cognitive Imaging Center, and you're a principal investigator at Columbia's Zuckerman Institute. So you're a busy guy. You also write a blog of sorts called Open Brain Science, and it's really what it is. It's a thorough breakdown and review of recent research articles that you choose to cover. Now, a few episodes ago, I had Dan Yeamans on, and we talked about his work modeling the visual system with convolutional neural networks. And you put out a paper that same year in 2014, and these two papers, the one that he and I talked about and yours, are the ones that are always cited when people talk about the beginning of how CNNs were being used to model our visual system. And you've been beating the drum now for a few years that machine learning, and in particular deep learning, provides a great opportunity for computational neuroscience. So today we're going to talk broadly about that and issues surrounding it. Luckily for me, you've written a bunch of great review articles about these subjects. Now, we're going to focus mostly on deep neural network models today, but using one of your recent reviews in Nature Neuroscience called Cognitive Computational Neuroscience, I took a big sheet of my children's drawing paper and made a mind map for myself of all the types.
Oh, that's great. I love mind maps.
Yeah, I don't often make them, but this one just cried out for it. So I made it. It's actually still on my desk, but it's basically all the types of models that are being used and how they relate to theory and experiment. Things like cognitive models, connectivity models, decoding models, and so on. I should send it to you. I'll take a picture of it and send it to you once I clean it up. But so thanks.
Oh, that would be great. Please do.
So, Nico, what is cognitive computational neuroscience?
It's cognitive science plus computational neuroscience plus AI. And it's not a field yet, but it's an idea, really. And it's quite an old idea. So it's been the idea that these fields study the same thing fundamentally has been around very long. Even the fathers of modern computing, Turing and von Neumann, were thinking about the brain and about the mind when they thought about how to design computers. So this idea is really very old, but to actually pull it off and bring people who are thinking about the brain and the mind at totally different levels together and to create a common language has always been a tall order. So historically, these separate fields have crystallized and focused on particular parts of the problem. So, for example, cognitive science has cared about the information processing and has tried to rigorously model the information processing with computational models without being encumbered by, at the same time, having to explain how it's implemented in the brain. And that's kind of a top-down approach to understanding brain information processing, where you're not really talking about the parts of the brain, the components in the brain, but you're talking about the information processing. And then computational neuroscience has taken a kind of bottom-up approach, where you look at the brain, you look at the neurons, you measure the neurons, you try to understand the dynamics in the neurons, but from the perspective of function, like how might this be useful for information processing? So you're describing how neurons and sort of small sets of interacting neurons can implement components that might be useful for a cognitive system. But between this top-down approach and the bottom-up approach, so far they haven't really become integrated. They haven't met in the middle. And that's the idea of cognitive computational neuroscience.
It seems kind of crazy, doesn't it, that they haven't really, that your idea is that these fields are kind of pointing to each other and need to be integrated using AI techniques. So why do they need each other? Why do these three subfields need each other?
So computational neuroscience needs cognition for direction, because you can't really figure out what the function is or what these little ensembles of interacting neurons are supposed to do if you don't look at how they come together to a more complex function that contributes to successful behavior. So that's why computational neuroscience needs cognitive science. And cognitive science needs computational neuroscience because cognition is grounded in the brain and is implemented in the brain. And you lack constraints when you just think about information processing in the abstract. There's not enough empirical constraint to find out, even, I would argue, and many cognitive scientists might disagree with me on that, even to understand cognition.
Do you get pushback? Do you get much pushback from colleagues, especially on the neuroscience side, for bringing in deep learning as a big part of this and using AI to sort of bridge these two computational neuroscience and from the bottom up and cognitive science from the top down?
Yeah, I mean, these are totally different levels of description. And you have to, as a scientist, you have to focus on something. You have to focus on a particular set of observations or on a particular set of methods or on a level of description at which to model what the brain does. And then you kind of fall in love with that particular level. And
right.
The result of that is that that's what fires up your imagination. And when you watch it, and the same is true for me, of course. You know, I'm here in a neuroscience institute where I go to talks where I don't know all of the terminology, and it's a totally different way of thinking about it. It addresses questions maybe at a much finer scale than what my work is about. So it's difficult for us to get excited about these totally different levels of thinking about what is the same big picture problem, understanding how the brain works, right? And that's why it's so hard to bring these communities together. In the abstract, it's easy to say, well, of course, we're all at some level working on the same question, so we should be working together. But then to actually make it happen is a much harder task. But I think there's a new dynamic now.
Well, so as science pushes on, we become more and more specialized in general. But this is kind of an argument that we need to become more broadly minded, or at least collaborate and reach over the aisle and collaborate more. Do I have that right?
I think that's generally true, yeah. So we need to come together. That's what we need the conference for. We need to understand each other's language, and we need to understand, importantly, why it is essential for what we care about to understand the other fields.
Well, yeah, so let's talk about the conference. So you just had your second annual Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference. So you're bringing together people from these somewhat disparate specialized fields in the same conference. And I mean, it's somewhat difficult to discuss brains and neural networks together, I find. So neurons and units, those words, are really interchangeable in both fields. So you can talk about, in artificial networks, you can call them neurons or units. And in brains, you can call them neurons and units. I mean, my preference is to call artificial units, and brain cells neurons.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Because I don't want to have to say, oh, you do? Okay. I don't want to have to say biological neurons each time.
But it's true. It's really, I've never thought about it, but neuroscientists also call biological neurons units sometimes in electrophysiology, for example. And that's really confusing. So let's agree to call the artificial ones units and the biological ones neurons. And that brings up the first sort of big disconnect, I would say, you know, that neural network models are called neural networks when, of course, there's no neurons in them. And any neuroscientist who cares about ion channels and multi-compartment dynamics and structures of dendritic trees and maybe computation in dendritic trees is rightly offended by the term neural network when, you know, a unit in a neural network is computes a linear combination and passes it through a static nonlinearity. That's very, very understandable. And it was, you know, in a way, a misnomer. It was when people first used it, I actually don't know the history at all, but, you know, I imagine it was just a kind of naivete, right? And so it's kind of almost ironic that it's being vindicated as a key element for bringing these fields together, a very powerful common modeling language that connects the three fields, cognitive science and computational neuroscience and AI.
Do you think we're stuck with the terminology?
I think we're stuck with the terminology, yes.
Yeah. So this conference that you put on, I don't know if the videos for the talks are available on this year, are available online
yet. They will
yet,
be. But everything will be available, yeah. It's being edited.
Okay. Yeah, that's a lot of work. I've enjoyed multiple videos from last year's conference, so I'll link at least to that so to give people a feel for it. So what are some of the challenges, like linguistically, semantically, conceptually, culturally even, for bringing folks like this in these different fields together?
So cognitive scientists look at behavior. They look at the overall function, and then they try to come up with algorithms that might provide these functions. And then they implement those algorithms, usually using computer science techniques, and sort of symbolic level algorithms that are very difficult to map onto the brain, either conceptually or sort of piece by piece in terms of their components. And then they predict behavior, and they do behavioral experiments, and they compare the behavior of their algorithms to the behavior of humans. And so they have a totally different language that doesn't necessarily relate to the brain in every single case. So that's one problem. And, you know, in the other direction, similarly, neuroscientists are looking at the biology, and they're looking at lots of biological phenomena, some of them dynamic. Those are probably the ones closer to functions, such as spiking and dynamics within neurons and ion channels and all of that. And perhaps they go a step further and they take all that knowledge and they assemble it into simulations where you have a set of neurons interacting, and then you have network phenomena there, and maybe these simulations produce oscillations or something like that. But it's very far from the information processing function of the brain, right?
Yeah. You know, let's say a big brawl breaks out. Who's going to win it, the computational neuroscientists or the cognitive scientists?
Oh, neither. They each of them has half the truth or a third of the truth, I'd say.
Any big brawls break out at the conference?
Not really, probably because it's a self-selected group, right? The people who come to this conference, they're already quite open-minded and they're interested in learning about the other disciplines.
So like I said, it's only 2 years old now. So when did you have the idea for it? How long was it in the making?
So I didn't have the idea. The idea was from Kendrick Kay and Thomas Nassalaris.
I see. And
these are very good computational neuroscientists and friends of mine, and they approached me about it. I want to say it was in Hawaii at a conference, but I could be wrong about that. I kind of have a recollection of a restaurant setting where we were having dinner, and they pitched this idea to me, and my response was, do we really need another conference?
Yeah. Well, are you glad you have it? Are you looking forward to next year?
Yes, I am. So, okay. I mean, it took, you know, a few minutes, I guess, you know, first when they mentioned it, I thought of all the work it would be to organize it. And we already have too many conferences, you know, I want to focus on my science and my lab. But then, They made a good case that actually there is no conference really bringing these three fields together. And, it resonated with me because I've been going to other conferences that are great and that I love and that I'll always be going to, including COSINE, the Computational and Systems Neuroscience Conference, and VSS, the Vision Sciences Conference, and OHBM, the Human Brain Mapping Conference, and the Society for Neuroscience Conference. So, and NIPS, of course, the Neural Information Processing Systems, which is more on the engineering side. So all these conferences are great, but none of them really brings these three communities together in quite the way that Kendrick and Thomas were envisioning. So, you know, after about 5 minutes, I was convinced and totally on it.
Good. Well, I'm glad you're doing it. And I'm really thankful you guys post the videos on YouTube, because it's a great resource. All right. So let's talk about how deep neural network models can help us understand the brain, because this is the AI, the neural networks are in the middle between the top-down cognitive science and the approach and the bottom-up computational neuroscience approach. So you wrote this great review a few years ago, right when machine learning models were starting to catch on and resemble what's happening in our brains. And near the beginning of the review, you provide this table. And in the table, you illustrate the history of trying to understand how the brain works. So in rows, you list the elements required for understanding how brains work. Things like, is it neurally plausible? Does it provide neural data, etc.? And in each column is a different historical field of study. Things like cognitive psychology, computational neuroscience, and so on. And if a given field of study satisfies a given element required for understanding brains, you just simply put a check mark in that box. So, for example, cognitive neuroscience gets a check mark for explaining real-world tasks that require complex computations, and it gets other check marks. But what jumps out immediately when one looks at the table, you notice, oh, poor behaviorism. The only check mark it gets is for collecting behavioral data. So this This refers to, of course, how behaviorism treated our brains like black boxes.
Yeah.
And so it only examines what goes into the black box, things that we sense, and what comes out of the black box, namely our behaviors. Anyway, it just amused me, that table. I don't know if anyone else has commented to you about that, but...
Not really, no. You're the first. I'm remembering it now. I didn't even remember I put behaviorism in there, but I guess you must be right.
Yeah, it just gets dragged through the mud so much these days. It's
funny. I mean, no one talks about the cognitive revolution anymore, right? When people started arguing that we have to theorize about what goes on inside the brain, about the information processing, right? And then cognitive psychology started doing that, and in a somewhat vague way with these box and arrow models where they were talking about the decomposition of the functions that the brain computes into components. And you could somewhat behaviorally study that, but the models weren't fully explicit. They weren't things that you could run on a computer and really see what the interaction of all the proposed elements really entails and whether it can explain task performance. So that's, in my mind, what cognitive science contributed to the endeavor. And that's really a key part to the whole story of understanding the brain.
You're right. That story, as we advance more and more, seems to get told less and less, but it is a key development. Okay, so you stress that if deep neural networks are going to be helpful in understanding brains, that we need to use methods to compare the models, the neural networks, and brains' internal representations while performing a task successfully, while the models are performing a task successfully. So what are some of the ways that deep neural networks can be tested with brain and behavioral data?
Yeah, maybe let's slightly backtrack. Why deep neural networks, right? We talked about cognitive science before, and cognitive science has symbolic models that are not deep neural networks, and these are also important to me. I mean, these are part of cognitive computational neuroscience, and we need them as well, right? So it's not only about deep neural networks. But if you're interested in taking the step of sort of bridging down to biology, then deep neural networks are especially appealing. And they've been around for very long. They have a long history, and they have a long history actually in each of these three fields, importantly, right? So in cognitive science, deep neural networks brought a paradigm shift in the 80s called parallel distributed processing. And a lot of the very important papers on how deep neural networks compute are actually came out of cognitive science and came out in cognitive science journals. So there's a long history there. And then in computational neuroscience, there's a long history also of neural network models at various levels of biological detail, including spiking neural networks or more abstracted neural networks. There's a lot of theoretical work on recurrent neural networks and the emergent dynamics from kind of a physics perspective. And so they've always been key there in computational neuroscience to understanding the dynamics in biological systems. And then in AI, they, for a long time, didn't really deliver on their promise, so they couldn't really, they weren't really state-of-the-art solutions, for example, to computer vision and to other engineering problems. And I remember as a student in computer science, our professor talked about neural networks, so that was taught, but, you know, in a very sort of negative way. You know, you could tell that... he thought that that was not a rigorous engineering solution because there was not very good theory for understanding what goes on in these complex systems. And there are other models, such as support vector machines, for which we had better mathematical theory for understanding what goes on. And they were simpler. And actually, they worked just as well at the time, maybe even better in certain contexts than neural networks. So at the time, neural networks, when I was an undergraduate, were not considered state-of-the-art engineering solutions. But that all changed in 2012 with AlexNet, when AlexNet won the ImageNet competition by a large margin. The whole field of computer vision sort of realized this is the way to go. We have to automatically learn these internal representations rather than hand engineer them, and there was no looking back. And this has been extended to other domains of perception, but also to higher cognitive challenges such as language processing, language translation, and motor control, robotic control. So now deep learning is really a very successful component of machine learning and AI. And that's really very exciting because it means that a modeling framework that is neurobiologically plausible in the sense that it's very easy to imagine implementing all the computations that deep neural networks use with biological neurons, right? So they only use a small subset of what you could call the dynamic repertoire of biological brains, but the functions that they do use definitely are very plausible. And within this framework, now you can do cutting-edge AI, which you need to be, if you want to explain how the brain works. The brain is intelligent. You need to make models that can perform intelligent tasks, right? That are intelligent themselves. So that's mm-hmm. that's a key requirement. And then the links to cognitive science and to computational neuroscience are the historical links, and so the common literature there, these are further factors that place this modeling framework really at the center of cognitive computational neuroscience.
Yeah, I guess so the same thing that behaviorism gets knocked for, neural nets have kind of historically gotten knocked for, and that there have been black boxes, but that's starting to change because so you have these deep neural networks that can perform the cognitive tasks, but what good are they if we can't understand how they're performing it and what's going on inside the network? So in your review, you actually talk about multiple ways that we can study these things and
exactly.
compare them to brains.
So black box is really entirely the wrong term. I would call them white boxes.
I agree.
I think I got that from Dan Yamans, actually. So white box is a better term because they're entirely transparent. You have access to everything, right? That said, what people mean when they say that is these systems are themselves very complex. And just because you've got a neural net model with millions of parameters that can perform your task and predict perhaps errors in behavior and reaction times and brain activity. That's what we want, of course, right? But they say even if you have that, you still don't understand your model. So have you made theoretical progress? And the answer to that is it's true that once we have that, we're not done. We still want a more abstract level of theoretical understanding. We want theory in addition to models. However, having models is a necessary component and is a big step in the direction of getting the theory right as well. Because if we don't have models that can perform the task, if our theories are not instantiated in models that pass the first test of being able to perform the behavior, then we're not explaining how cognition is implemented in the brain, right? So once we, but let's assume, so it depends how it goes. It could go that, you know, you have the theory first, you implement the theory, you test the theory, it works, and then you have theory and a model, and the model helps you test the theory, and then you're done for some restricted task. Right. Of course, that doesn't mean you understand all aspects of how the brain works. It means you understand brain information processing in some animal for some restricted task environment. Right.
Yeah.
But it could also go the other way around. And that's what the people talking about the black box problem, which is actually the white box problem, are thinking of, is that you play with these models. You really forget about theory, which is what they care about. And now you have this model with millions of parameters, and let's say it does very well, it can perform the task, and it predicts errors that people make, and it predicts reaction times or motor dynamics or something like that, and it generalizes to new, if it's a visual task, new images or new environments. So it's not just sort of overfitted to your particular sort of small toy version of the task, but it really generalizes to the real world. So that's great. But they say, but you still don't understand how this dynamic system with millions of parameters is doing it, right? And my answer to that is, yes, you're right. Now there's the second job, but now we're much closer because we've downloaded the mechanism into the simulation, which is entirely transparent, which we can probe cheaply with millions of images. We can study it much more easily with synthetic neurophysiology. So we're in a much better position also if we go from the model, from the bottom up more, from the model with the many parameters to the theory, we're also in a better position using these models.
I remember, I'm burning up inside right now because thinking about the white box, because when I started neurophysiology, I was recording neurons from monkey frontal eye field while they performed little tasks with their eyes, making saccades. But when I started off, we were using single electrodes, you know, so I could maximally get maybe 2 to 3 neurons at a time. But, you know, the motto from my old advisor, Mark Summer, was one neuron a day. You know, that's a good day, one neuron. So it's just,
go ahead. It takes 100 billion days then, right?
That's right. Oh, boy, and it sure did take that long. But anyway, so I think that this is a huge benefit to be able to, examine all of the units. Anything that you want is there for the taking. So I think that's great. So what are some of the ways that we can understand what's going on inside these networks and compare them to how brain and behavior are happening?
So we need to first bring cognition into the laboratory, right? It all starts with cognitive science in a sense, both historically with task performing models and also sort of in the cycle of the work. First, we need to think about what is the function that I want to explain. And in order to bring that function, that piece of cognition, that piece of the mind into the laboratory, we need to define a task. And this task is usually going to be some kind of computer game. So it's going to be something, it's going to be an interaction where there are stimuli and there are responses, and we want to be able to record the responses and present the stimuli and close the loop and present many different kinds of versions of this more general task and measure behavior, right? And that it doesn't matter whether we're studying animals or people, this is a common element. And once we've done that, we can start studying it. And the natural starting point is the overall performance at the task, right? So we want to see how well can our subjects, for example, our human subjects or our animal subjects, perform the task? Under what conditions do they make errors? What are their reaction times? When are they slower, perhaps? And try to understand why certain versions, why certain stimuli, for example, are hard to recognize. And this gives us clues as to the computational mechanism. And then we can start modeling this. So we want to build a computer model that can perform the task. And that means that the model has to be able to interface with the software that presents the task to humans or animals, and it has to be able to perform the task, and it should be able to perform the task at the same general level of performance as the animal or the human subject. So that is, in a way, the first test of a task-performing model, or what I also call a brain computational model.
Yeah, I should just say also that that's not the goal in, let's say, industry, to make models that will match the behavior. The goal is always to be most efficient and, outperform behavior. But if you're trying to understand brains, you need it to match the actual human behavior or animal behavior.
Absolutely. And that's a distinct goal. And in some areas where the performance of current models is very far from human performance, these two are very similar, right? Because the sort of, if you want to explain human behavior, first you have to be in the ballpark and be able to do the task at all. Otherwise, you're just in the dark with understanding the particular way in which humans solve the task.
Good. Okay. So a lot of the neural network models that are being used, like to study the visual system and model the visual system, are mostly feed-forward models, meaning that you put input in the model, it goes through all the units, all the layers, and then spits out an answer. And of course, there's back propagation. But there, historically, until recently, there haven't been many recurrent connections in the models. I mean, there have been recurrent neural networks. But so recently, these convolutional neural network models are beginning to incorporate some recurrent connections in them as well. So can you just talk a little bit about feed-forward and recurrent computation in brains and in neural networks and what roles they might play?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So the feed-forward models have been very successful in vision, and both in the neuroscience of vision and in computer vision. So the kinds of models that do vision, for example, in our cell phones and the technology that we're using to communicate right now, those are likely feed-forward convolutional neural network models. And in the neuroscience of vision, similarly, feed-forward models have been very popular and very successful. And that's because the visual hierarchy is a deep hierarchy. Vision is very rapid. We can glean a lot of knowledge from a very brief glimpse at a scene. And so that is a very fast process that doesn't allow for much recurrent computation, even though the brain is recurrently connected at all levels and within layers as well as between layers. So we've always known that the connectivity structure is recurrent, but it just made a lot of sense to first focus on sort of the feed-forward sweep through the system, which already can explain some of the behavioral function of sort of basic recognition of the things, the kinds of stuff and the kinds of objects that are present in a visual image. So that was good, and I think there's real progress. And with the advent of deep convolutional neural networks, there's been really a sudden breakthrough in this game. So the classical game of computational visual neuroscience was to predict the response of a neuron to arbitrary natural images, and so you'd have this little model of brain, the eye and the retina, and then the brain do with the image in order to produce the response of the neuron. And maybe for primary visual cortex, you abstract from the biological details, for example, the retinal processing to some extent, you come up with a simplified slightly higher level model like a Gabor filter model. And this allows you to predict responses in V1 to arbitrary images to some extent. And maybe you can explain 50% of the variance. So that was one very big early success story of computational visual neuroscience. But then when you try to take that to V2 and V4 and IT, it gets progressively harder. And in V4, it's already extremely hard to come up with these models and fit these models with the limited kind of neural response data that we can realistically acquire. And in IT, it was always just impossible, right? And after convolutional neural nets had this breakthrough in computer vision, several of us, including Jim DiCarlo's group at MIT and my group, and then Yamin's and Jim DiCarlo's group, started using these models to predict responses in higher level visual cortices. And we found that these models beat all other models that we ever tried. So we had scores of other models, many of them computer vision, many of them much less neurobiologically plausible than neural networks. And suddenly we got sort of two things together, which seemed almost unthinkable. A model that's neurobiologically plausible is abstract. We want it to be abstract, right? As abstract as possible, but still neurobiologically plausible. And a model that actually works and allows us to predict responses and representations, patterns of activity elicited by novel images in these high-level regions. So that was a very big breakthrough, and these models were completely feed-forward. At the same time, for me, this meant sort of the end of an era, right? So this was always the impossible thing. This was the hard thing, and now we can do that to some extent. We're still not explaining all the variants, mind you, right? So we're not there yet, far from it, but suddenly it seems not that different than in early visual areas where we're also not explaining all the variants, right? Mm. But at the same time, for me, this meant that this is, in a sense, I mean, you can still play this game, and we should be playing this game for another 2 decades to sort out all the details and get feed-forward models that correspond layer by layer to the areas of the visual system and maybe incorporate skipping connections and things like that. But at the same time, the feed-forward paradigm is becoming somewhat exhausted in my mind. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, this is all right, and this is correct, and it's a portion of what is going on, but it is a very small part of what vision is about. Because vision is more than opening your eyes and immediately having a sense of the stuff and the things that are there. Vision is a process of inference. Vision is relating. It's a superpower by which you relate all the things around you instantly to your goals and your knowledge in a very deep way. You have a sense of your surroundings, of the geometry of your surroundings, and of the meaning of all the things in there and how they interact. And that's a much more cognitive and a much more computationally complex process. And I think that should be our target. That's what we need to crack next.
Well, I feel compelled as well to, you know, we have talked, everyone that I've talked to who's using the convolutional neural nets to model vision, it's always the ventral stream that's being modeled. So that's where we recognize objects and abstract things. But there's a neglected dorsal stream of processing as well.
Where absolutely.
Where we process motion and where things are. So, yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off there. So that's good. You just described how abstracted artificial neurons are from real neurons. And of course, that is an understatement. If you ask any ionic channel researcher, like you said before. But so how biologically realistic or how least abstracted do you think that we're going to need to eventually make models to understand the brain's computations and functions, whatever that means?
Yes. So we have this set of tools from AI and machine learning, and deep neural networks are a big one. But even all of them together don't come anywhere close to modeling what the human brain and biological brains more generally can do. Even in vision, and certainly in other domains when it's about deeper inferences, we don't really have artificial general intelligence yet. So there's clearly something that we're missing with all of the models that we have now. And that's a great mystery. And that's why it continues to be important, even if you only care about the engineering perspective, to think about the brain, because the brain is, or the human brain is one example of a system that clearly goes beyond anything that we can build at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I think, therefore, you know, if engineers are working on AI technologies, they might not care so much about biology, because they want to optimize a particular system for a particular application, and they've got enough to worry about. But I think even in engineering, even if your ultimate goal is just to make AI and make really push the envelope of AI towards artificial general intelligence, people who care about that often are also deeply interested in the brain. because it's got these tricks that we can glean from it. And part of it is going to be, you know, in the biological details that we're currently not capturing with these models. Only we don't know exactly which details matter.
Do you think that we might, that it's possible that we could be suffering from what's called the curse of knowledge, right? I think I have this right. But you believe that we have to understand cognition, have to understand brains to really develop a general AI. Am I right about that? I'm just, you know, I'm wondering if we're limited just because that's what we know. Right?
Maybe I wouldn't put it quite like that. I don't think it's impossible that we will develop artificial general intelligence without understanding the brain. And it would be a very good, so if engineering achieved that without caring about the brain, then that would be very helpful for brain scientists, because that would give us even better tools for modeling intelligence in general, which we could then apply to understanding the brain, right? So I think that is very possible. But at the moment, we're in a position where the brain can do things that we can't do with engineering. And so naturally, you know, instead of reinventing it, we might be tempted to peek at the only existing solution.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned skip connections possibly being important. And those are just
We haven't really talked about recurrent. You asked me about recurrent.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Sure. Please.
So recurrent connections, I think, are absolutely key to all of this. And they're ubiquitous in the visual system in particular, but of course, throughout the brain. And they enable the system to base inferences on previous inferences. So basically to go on computing on the basis of the outputs of previous computations, and that enables the brain to use time as a computational resource. As long as you're just sweeping through a feed-forward network, very quickly you run out of layers, so you run out of neuronal resources to do that. And so it's very inflexible, even though all these models are, you know, universal function approximators, and so can potentially approximate anything that you might want. They're limited because we're limited with the resources of the brain. And if we can recycle our resources through time, then we can compute much more interesting and useful functions.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I see in the literature, is just the advent of incorporating the recurrent connections within all the convolutional neural networks. And you have a recent piece on that yourself, so.
Yeah, so we think at the moment, you know, we think that the feed-forward convolutional framework, that is the new null hypothesis of the ventral stream. And so we want to take steps sort of starting with a system that we understand pretty well and we can get it to work. And we want to change one thing at a time so that we understand what we're doing and we can be on top of it. And so the straightforward way of bringing in recurrent dynamics, which potentially puts us in this whole new world of much more interesting computational powers, is to make the convolutional networks, hierarchical convolutional networks, recurrent. And that gives us these what we call BLT, bottom-up, lateral, and top-down connected convolutional neural networks. So now every unit doesn't only see a restricted receptive field in the layer below, but it also sees its neighbors within the same layer, and it sees a restricted receptive field in the layer above. And then it learns a little weight template, and it's still convolutional, so that weight template, which includes the B for bottom-up, the L for lateral, and T for top-down components, so it's sandwiched in between there. It's kind of a joke with the BLT. so that's that weight template is automatically generalized across spatial positions. So that means that that the number of parameters actually doesn't explode, and you can efficiently train these systems with backpropagation through time, and then you have a much more powerful and a very interesting framework. And so far we've seen that this just I was amazed how quickly my brilliant graduate student, Courtney Spura, and another graduate student who's now a postdoc at the NIH, Patrick McClure, got this to work. So it basically, without having to tinker endlessly with the architectural hyperparameters, basically out of the box, these models dominated parameter-matched feed-forward control models. So this is an important sort of framework that we're exploring at the moment.
So you mentioned backpropagation through time. So I've had recently, I had Blake Richards on the show, and I've had Adam Marblestone, and we've talked about how backpropagation or a process like it might be occurring in the brain, it might be implemented in the brain. And so what you've talked about so far with adding the recurrent connections is really just still connecting. It's almost like a different graph, right? You're still connecting the nodes, but in a way that allows it to have recurrence. But do you think that there are any, do any lower level features of neurons and the way that they process signals come to mind that you bet might be important to really making these systems more efficient and moving forward?
So you're talking about lower level biological features, how to incorporate biological realism?
Yes, incorporating biological realism into the models. So for instance, Blake Richards made this model where it's not just a single unit. His artificial unit also has a dendritic, like an apical dendrite that then can carry out backpropagation, et cetera. And so that was one way to incorporate biological realism. And I'm just wondering if you have other guesses or thoughts as to what might be important to include.
Yes. So I love that work. And I think it's right there in the realm of looking to biology for inspiration about how to make these systems function better. And everyone has a list of, I think, features of biology that might be interesting to incorporate. And I think we have to explore this whole space, and then everyone will have a different order of priority, and that's more subjective. That's more sort of the pragmatism of what will pay off and what sort of relates to what we've worked on before, what is a reasonable order in which to explore all these different things, right? So high up on my list is recurrent connectivity. Equally high up is skipping connections. And stochasticity, which is present in the brain throughout, and there are very interesting theories about how it might serve to represent uncertainty and compute with uncertainty, taking the process of computation in the direction of sort of the cognitive ideal of proper probabilistic inference. And so that's very high on my list. And then there are global aspects of the architecture. For example, how deep is it? What are the different areas? Can we take connectivity constraints directly from the literature, build them into the architecture, and then train with backpropagation and evaluate, different architectures and understand why the architecture, the global aerial connectivity of the visual system is the way it is. That's high on my list as well. And then, at some point we get down to questions like spiking. Do we need spiking neurons? There's a big computational neuroscience literature on spiking models. They're very difficult to train, but it's an interesting question whether spiking, which is known to help with long-range signaling in the brain, also has a computational function. For example, some people relate it to dropout in deep neural networks, where you have sort of this stochastic nature that can help regularize the learning process. And then there's a whole machine learning literature that reinterprets that in the context of probabilistic inference, where you have probabilistic inference at the level of learning, and then it's like a prior that regularizes the learning, but then you should carry over your uncertainty about the parameters that you've learned into the inference, the perceptual inference as well. So you should keep sampling from, so run the network with the stochasticity and then interpret the distribution of outputs as a representation of the posterior, so the probability distribution.
Is that work coming out of Tenenbaum's lab?
No, so I associate this in machine learning with Zubin Garamani's group, and in particular the graduate student Yarin Gao, who reinterpreted dropout in this way. There might be earlier work along these lines that he's drawing from interpreting this in the framework of variational inference. So this is something that we're also exploring, but at the moment we're not exploring this with spiking neural networks because they're very difficult to train, but we're exploring this with rate-coded neural network models where we're nimble with the training. We can use all the tools of deep learning, but in addition, we're bringing in this feature that's ubiquitous in biology and has these interesting links to machine learning, Monte Carlo and Markov chain Monte Carlo inference in machine learning. And we find that that actually does enable our models to represent their own uncertainty much more accurately. So when they're probabilistic estimates, you know, when you predict that it's going to rain with 80% probability, then out of all of those cases where you set that, when you look years later, ideally it rained in 80% of those cases. That would mean you had well-calibrated uncertainty, right? Unlike someone who's always sure and then half the time wrong, which is what neural networks in general can be if they're not sort of especially designed to deal well with uncertainty.
Yeah, I haven't had anyone yet on the show also who deals with the spiking neural networks either. And it's just interesting because spiking is such a fundamental neuronal process that, all these neural nets use rate coding instead.
So. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Nico, for this has been a really interesting talk. I have just a couple more questions if you have another minute or two. So you have the current state of brain science and the current state of artificial intelligence. So what do these things share? You know, where do brain science and AI overlap with the way things currently stand?
So there are all these things that the human brain can do that computers can't do yet. And that's where the common interest lies, right? And that's sort of, I'm thinking of DeepMind, for example. They're very much about AI, but they care deeply also about the brain because it inspires them, right? For good reason. They care about how the only system that implements these functions implements them. And I think, that's where the common interest is. So this is also related to the history of engineering that led into AI. So one strand of that is statistics, and another strand is computer science. And traditionally, statistics has optimized statistical efficiency, and computer science has optimized computational efficiency. And I think, until hearing a talk from, from Michael Jordan, I didn't really relate these two to each other, but they're deeply related. So statistical efficiency is all about being efficient with data, so making the best possible inferences given the limited data that you have available. And computational efficiency is all about having bounds on the runtime of your algorithm given some input. Mm. And because these were totally separate traditions, we haven't really understood how to integrate the two. And so, but now it just in engineering with big data, we're facing the challenges where we have to integrate them. So let me give you an example. So let's say you have web scale data to make some inference, right? And you know what kind of inference it is, and you can look up in your statistics textbook what the optimal algorithm would be for that. But then you find that it's so computationally inefficient that you can't run it on all of your data, right? So what you want to do to get the best possible answer, let's say you have a year and you have a limited budget for computation, what you want to do is run an algorithm that's not statistically optimal, but that strikes a good compromise between statistical and computational efficiency, and therefore, after 1 year, will give you the best answer. Mm-hmm. And we see exactly this trade-off also play out in brain science, where we have the more statistical tradition, which one instantiation is very important and influential is probabilistic graphical models. They're statistically very, very neat, and you can do inference on them, and they've been generalized in a way that they can grow with the data. And that's sort of this tradition. And then the neural network tradition, from my perspective, is more part of computer science, where the inference is more computationally efficient, but they need huge amounts of data, right?
Right.
So they come to be dominant in areas and in eras where you suddenly have so much data that this is not a problem anymore, right? That's why, you know, when we had web scale data for training computer vision models, suddenly neural networks, also became so powerful, right? But the brain manages to combine data efficiency and computational efficiency in ways that are beyond current AI. And I think that's one very deep mystery that is shared between brain science and engineering.
Interesting. Oh, this is all just so easy, isn't it?
I wish.
Yeah. So the further I went in my career in neuroscience, the more I heard people invoke David Marr's three levels of analysis. And you've written about that as well in some of your reviews. And just to go over them briefly, so David Marr proposes that three levels of analysis. One, at the highest level, is kind of computational theory, like what functions need to happen. Like What should the brain compute?
Way, right?
Thank you. Yeah. And then the next lower level is representation and what algorithms should be implemented to accomplish these things. And then at the lowest level is how the brain does it, the neurobiological implementation.
Yes.
And so this, you know, was referred to more and more, I felt like, as my little career went on. But how do you think historically we will view or appreciate David Marr's levels of analyses?
So first, in my mind, they map directly onto what we just talked about. So what should the brain compute? That's looking at at everything at a global level. You look at the whole animal and it's engaged in the task. So you want to understand what are the requirements of the task and what is the best way, what is the information processing that allows the animal to choose the best actions, right? And looking at it from that global level means that what you care about is what is the animal given? Well, it's given the data and it has to make good decisions, which is to make good inferences. And so it's all about being efficient with the data. So for, in my mind, the top level of computational theory is associated with statistical efficiency. And I think it's not a coincidence that many of the people in cognitive science that are at the intersection to statistics, and I'm thinking of Michael Jordan and Josh Tenenbaum and Tom Griffiths and others, they are very deeply invested in the statistical way of looking at things. Mm. And then if you go one level down to representations and algorithms, even these terms are computer science terms, right? So now it's about time complexity. It's about the steps of computation that you need to go through to compute the thing that you should compute. So now it's about what does the brain compute with the limited time that it has. Right, and then you could say one level down at the implementation on a level, then it's about space complexity. So you have limited components, and you're building the system up out of neurobiologically plausible components, where you also have a limited budget in terms of the number of neurons that you can use and how you can connect them such that the volume of the axons fits in the skull. And you have a limited energy budget as well, of course.
Yeah, it's an important one, I think. That topic is heating up, I feel like, in the literature.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful way of saying it.
Well, Nico, this has been a lot of fun for me. Thank you for joining me here on the show. There's so much more we could talk about, and I might just have to pester you again later to come back on the show. You're sure. Always invited back, of course. And before you go, where do you think people should go to find out more about you? I know your lab is on Twitter. Is that where you think people should seek more information?
Yes, I have a Twitter handle. I think the most important thing maybe is to go to the website of cognitive computational neuroscience, because there's good resources there. There's all the talk videos. That was very important to me that we put them all up there, so that it's more than just an event once a year, but people can engage sort of throughout the year. And we also have a historical record of all these, even contributed talks by students, but also, of course, the keynotes where we try to invite the leaders of the field, and many of them are really great. So I think that would be great if people check that out.
Okay, I'll definitely link to that in the show notes. And I know you've got to go because you must have some other conference right now that you're preparing for.
No, I've got a meeting with a graduate student.
Well, Nico, thanks again, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Paul.
All right, thanks again for listening. If you have questions or suggestions, email them to me, paul@braininspired.co. Kriegeskorte. Kriegeskorte. I'll keep working on it. See you next time.